KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby.
This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Welcome to a special edition of Civil Rights and Wrongs. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Two reasons why this is so special tonight. We are live in the co-op studios. And this is the first time since March 17th, 2020, that I have been behind the mic here. So thank you so much for joining us, everyone. Ours was actually the last show to play on co-op from the studio, live in the studio, before we moved entirely to at-home productions. And this is co-op's fall membership drive. With me here in the studio is Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, and Ken McKenzie Grant, a member of the co-op board of directors and a big fan of Civil Rights and Wrongs. How you doing, Michelle?
I'm great. It's so great to be back in the studio. This is kind of strange, but awesome. So I'm so glad to be here and talk about Membership Drive with Ken and Bob. We got a great show coming up tonight, so we'll get right to it as soon as we talk to you a little bit about what's going on with Membership Drive this time.
Sure. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you both for all your work here, Bob and Michelle. Jim's not with us tonight, but Jim Harrington is a big part of this program and part of the reason that I'm so proud of what you guys are doing. Folks, it takes a huge volunteer effort, I might remind you, to come up each week and produce our news and public affairs shows, all of them for co-op. But we're asking you right now to make a one-time donation of, I would suggest, at least $100 on online at koop.org, co-op.org, so we can send you our new fall t-shirt, or you could call our operators at 512-472-5667. Folks are standing by, and especially if you've never supported, especially our talk programs, news and public affairs here at co-op, we would love to hear from you and thank you on the air tonight. The number again is 512-472-5667, y'all. Your sustaining pledge, I might remind you, of $15 a month can keep you informed with this kind of in-depth information streaming and on air at 91.7 FM for the next 6 months. This hour today is our last chance to contribute this particular year, so please let us know it's made a difference in the quality of your awareness of weekly life here in Austin. Give us a call right now.
And we have a special promotion tonight, too, in honor of our day, our first time back on the air. We are giving away a t-shirt, a special Civil Rights and Wrongs t-shirt.
Oh, cool.
We had printed, yes. And so at that initial membership level of $100 for a one-time donation or $15 per month sustainer, you, if you are the first of three callers at that level or above, of course, we will send you one of our special Civil Rights and Wrongs t-shirts. And we have them in a large, extra large, and a medium only. So if you want your choice of sizes, be the first one to call in and you can choose it.
We'll tell you about the logo when we come back. It's really cool.
Okay. Well, tonight we're going to do a best of episode. And I've brought excerpts from some of our favorite programs that aired earlier this year. And let's get right into it. Our first selection is from February 23rd. Michelle, Jim, and I spoke with Jeff Littlejohn, professor of history at Sam Houston State University. He's also the director of the Lynching in Texas Project. Here's a portion of our conversation with him.
Our guest this evening is Dr. Jeffrey Littlejohn, a professor of history at Sam Houston State University at Huntsville, Texas. Dr. Littlejohn is a scholar and author of several books and articles documenting desegregation struggles and other pivotal moments during the civil rights movement in the United States. He enjoys collaborating on various projects with honors and graduate students at Sam Houston, one of the more recent and extensive being the creation of a website dedicated to documenting all of the recorded lynchings that have occurred in Texas between 1882 and 1942.
One of the things that is so crucial right now, I think, in the rewriting of Texas history and U.S. history more broadly is bringing about a realistic view of what happened, not this whitewashed celebration of the great white men and women of history, but really looking at the day-to-day events that drove history forward and the people who made those possible. In addition to that, you've got mixed into that history, the racial violence, the white supremacy, the segregation, the disfranchisement, the white primary, the poll tax, the literacy test, and everything else that we talk about in collegiate courses on U.S. history. And so what we're trying to do in partnership with the Equal Justice Initiative is not only set up this website, but our next step is working with the Equal Justice Initiative to put historical markers on the ground in places like Houston, where County Commissioner Rodney Ellis is establishing four historical markers on the four lynching victims in Harris County. And I'm working with teams in both Montgomery and Walker County to do the same. What these will do is help young people and the general population realize that these horrible events did happen. We have to recognize them. We have to talk about them. If we're going to move forward and have some kind of reconciliation on the matters of race and discrimination in this country. So Brian Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative has made a lot of that possible. As you all probably know, in fact, Austin had, if not the first, one of the first lynching historical markers in the state of Texas through the Equal Justice Initiative. But historical markers in Texas have required the approval of the Texas Historical Commission, which is basically run by old white people. And for the most part, that organization and the countywide historical commissions in each of the 254 counties of Texas are very conservative and very white. They have no interest in historical markers regarding lynching, racial violence, or discrimination. And so what Brian Stevenson's organization has done is allowed people like myself and people like Rodney Ellis and our team in Harris County to bypass, in some sense, these historical commissions and seek to tell the real story without having to get the approval of the people who would stop us, who would prevent the telling of the real history.
The memorial is here in Austin.
It's at the Wesley United Methodist Church over in East Austin, and it was dedicated in December, I believe, of 2017.
Yeah, so it would definitely be one of the first then. In Houston, County Commissioner Rodney Ellis and his team are developing an entire park. It's going to be called Quibido Park. It's going to be downtown. There'll be four historical markers there. I've been lucky enough to work with them throughout on that project. But Austin, as always, is leading the way. And we're following up and trying to catch up to you as quick as we can.
I'm just curious, talking about U.S. history here, so much of this seems to have climaxed right around World War I. And I remember reading about Black soldiers who were not welcomed back at all, and as a matter of fact, were treated rather violently in many cities. Do you have any sense about why things happened in the order that they did, why things got so bad in the World War I era?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, World War I was a pivotal turning point in racial violence in the United States and in Texas in particular. Of course, the article that really got me into this whole process was an article I wrote with a couple of graduate students on the Cabanis family lynching that occurred June 1st, 1918 in Walker County, Texas, right outside of Huntsville, where I teach. Basically, this involved a Black resident of Walker County who had been drafted to fight in World War I. And he claimed that he was too young to be part of the draft. He was arrested and later confronted by an individual in town who said, you know, we're going to get you. This was a white individual. We're going to get you. You're going to get drafted. And the white individual alleged that this man named George Cabanis pulled a gun on him. What just so happened that the white individual who made this claim was the father-in-law of the sheriff of Walker County, whose name was T.E. King. So the next day, T.E. King sent officers to George Cabanis' house and shot and killed him in his front door. That was May 31st. The next day, June 1st, a mob of whites went to the Cabanis home, set it on fire, and as the five members of the Cabanis family, the mother, Sarah Cabanis, and four of her children came out of the house, the mob, which included T.E. King, C.B. Birmingham, who was the marshal of Huntsville and a local justice of the peace, opened fire on the Black family and killed all the members except one, Bessie Cabanis. Now, the only reason we know what happened there is because Bessie Cabanis survived. And the next year, 1919, she gave her firsthand personal account in writing to the NAACP branch that was founded in Galveston. Galveston sent that letter to the national NAACP. And so the letter is now a part of the national NAACP archives. And we were able to find that letter, locate the historical persons that she mentions by name, including T.E. King, C.B. Birmingham, and others, and really try to retell that tale. But to get back to your question, so your question is, why does World War I see this spark in violence? Well, the main reason is because of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a Southern, he was a Virginian. He segregated the civil service of the United States. He segregated Washington, D.C. And he also said that World War I was the war to make the world safe for democracy. Wilson was the guy who showed Birth of a Nation, the most racist film, perhaps of the 20th century, that portrays the Ku Klux Klan as the heroes and Black men as rapists. He showed that film at the White House and called it Writing History with Lightning. In 1915 to 1918, we have a president who simultaneously is talking about a war abroad in which we are going to force young men to join the military, to fight abroad, to save democracy, while simultaneously he is segregating the civil service, he is condemning Black Americans, he is celebrating the Ku Klux Klan. And that is the dichotomy at the heart of World War I America. And that is the heart of the racist tension of the era. And not unlike what we saw on January 6th, 2021, I have to say.
So that was Jeffrey Littlejohn, and he talks about his website that is lynchingintexas.org, lynchingintexas.org, and plenty of more information there about his work and the project. So, Ken, how are we doing here?
We're doing fine, but I got to say, wow, Bob, that particular segment and that subject, along with misguided United States presidents like Wilson and Andrew Jackson, another least favorite of mine, really pushes my intellectual and emotional buttons. And folks, if it pushes yours, we want to invite you to help us with what we're doing, like continuing to bring you this sort of information. It's serious food for thought that you might consider coming to you from this nonprofit little community radio station. No matter where you are, we'd love to hear from you now, and we're inviting your pledge of financial support for the program at whatever level suits your budget. Help us reach that now in spite of this continued national lockdown. We'd like you to call our operators at 512-472-5667 as soon as you can so you don't miss the next recap segment that's coming up. Again, you can pledge online if you prefer that, kop.org. We've got a lot of different levels. Our volunteers will be glad to tell you about some of the great gift items that we've got, including that special t-shirt just for you Civil Rights and Wrongs listeners.
Yes. So definitely call us or go online. It's been our pleasure to serve you all this time on this show. We've really enjoyed being a part of Co-op and providing this NPA program and all of the great topics that we brought you. So please do call and let us know you appreciate it. That's the best way you can show that you appreciate us is just by giving us a donation so we can keep doing this for you. And again, we've got that t-shirt. So please give us a call.
512-472-5667. Okay, our next selection is from June 22nd. We spoke with Michael Barajas from the Texas Observer and Maggie Luna from the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition. We quickly moved into a discussion about bills before the Texas legislature that would improve facilities in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which is to say that the state prisons. During the long summer, Texas prisons become veritable ovens. We pick up with Michael telling us about Terry Canales, Democratic state representative from the Valley, who is a strong advocate for prison reform.
Our guests this evening include Michael Barajas, staff writer for the Texas Observer. During the past year, he has written stories dealing with police misconduct, voter intimidation, and the rights of protesters, among other issues. Last month, he wrote a piece titled, Yet Again, Texas Lawmakers Face Crisis Conditions in Texas Prisons. We also have Maggie Luna, Mental Health Peer Policy Fellow for the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition, where she is focused on creating advocacy opportunities for system-impacted Texans.
So Terry Canales, state Democratic member from the Valley, and he's filed for several sessions the bills requiring TDCJ to put in AC or climate control plan or, you know, different variations of that. And he's become increasingly vocal and I think frustrated as sessions go on and people are ignoring this. And this year, I think he put it pretty succinctly where he was like, I think we have a give a damn problem. The conditions that Maggie was describing earlier that she and thousands of other people endure that churn through the system every year. Don't tolerate that unless you're looking the other way. You know, pigs have climate control. You know, that lends to this sort of lack of oversight, lack of accountability that you were sort of talking about, Jim. On another front, there are bills proposed every session to implement basic oversight over the Texas prison system because of a lot of the crises that we're describing. I think this year, what we saw during COVID should have sort of emphasized the need for that kind of oversight. I mean, during the worst of the pandemic, we saw like local officials with state prisons in their backyards accusing the agency of misrepresenting basic facts that could have implicated their communities as cases and deaths were soaring behind bars. And yet some of these oversight bills like didn't even get a hearing this session. So yeah, as far as that like give a damn problem, I think there's just quite frankly, a lot of people at the legislature that for one reason or another are ignoring these issues.
I think Terry Canales was amazing this session. And, you know, I just wanted to add, what is the mental cost when somebody is sitting in a prison, dying, sweating, melting, and you know that even the pigs have AC, but you don't deserve it. I mean, the mental state that puts you in is just, and then we come home, you know, we don't die in there. Not everybody does. We don't all get life sentences. So this is what treatment we're getting while we're in there. And then we come home with resentment and anger and frustration. So it's not only a crime against humanity, but it's also the community for whenever we come out.
Maggie, I'm curious about what turned you into activism. and how you then proceeded along that path.
Well, actually, it was when I was in prison, laying on my bunk, saying, somebody's got to know that we're dying in here, you know? And when I got out, I was actually not sure what, because of the life that I've lived for the past 20 years, the only life that I knew was street life and prison life. So I wasn't sure how I was going to do it, but I got out and I asked for help, and I found a place called Santa Maria that really helped me to become an adult in public. And I met Anthony Graves, death row exoneree number 138. And he was working with the ACLU doing a Smart Justice Speakers Bureau. And he started showing me that our stories have power. And we need to show these people that we are not going to continue cycling through their system. I mean, he really just empowered me to become a voice for the voiceless.
So there was one other bill that was getting at least initially some traction. And by the way, 1971, as you pointed out, Maggie, really did have quite a bit of support, at least in the House, you know, before it died in the Senate. Can either of you talk about this HB 1921? I think it was facilities modernization.
Well, this is something that really, like you said, I think it got some attention, or at least I started paying attention to it more as I saw more and more advocates get kind of freaked out by the proposal. You know, we talked about a lot of the challenges facing TDCJ and the state prison system. Part of that is just these are crumbling buildings that have not had a lot of attention. Some of them that are super old, or they were built really fast during like the great prison buildup in the 80s and 90s. So that's why a lot of them don't have AC. There are multi-million dollar, you know, deferred maintenance costs that are racking up every session. We know the prison population is getting older, and that brings more medical challenges that we already know the system is bad at keeping up with. On one end, you know, there's this discussion, you know, from the advocacy community that's been happening for a long time, which is basically how to decarcerate Texas prisons. And there's a history there, a bipartisan history. The state, after the great prison buildup about a couple of decades ago, really faced, you know, multi-billion dollar prison building costs if it wanted to keep incarcerating people at the rate that it was. You know, advocates would like to shrink the system more, right? In part because of a lot of the challenges that we're talking about, that you, with the understaffing situation, and that you just cannot keep humane prisons at the size of mass incarceration in Texas at the moment. And that's why you see advocates proposing, one proposal we saw this year, like to reform treatment and rehab programs so that people aren't just like stuck in prison after they've already been approved for release by the parole board. We saw thousands of people like just waiting behind bars that had already been approved for release during the pandemic as coronavirus was like raging through the prison system. You know, so smart sort of initiatives to reduce the prison population and hopefully sort of solve some of these issues in the process. On the other side, you know, you've got this build better facilities kind of argument. And that's essentially what this plan to modernize facilities would have been. It was proposed by like a long-term member of the House Corrections Committee, James White, kind of modeled after this plan to fix Alabama's like notoriously bad prisons, which Black Lives Matter activists have been pushing against in that state. Essentially, it's to tap private industry, private prison companies to help build new facilities over the next several years. Texas hasn't gone down that route, right? I mean, this bill, it ended up dying in the House after getting out of committee. I don't know if we'll see this in the future. I do think it's a sign of how this discussion could move in the future. You see it even sort of at the local level a little bit too here in Travis County. People are probably familiar with like the women's jail project, which just got punted for another year. But the conditions there are pretty notoriously bad. And so there's been this proposal, multi-million dollar proposal to build a better, more, the term that they use is trauma-informed women's jail. There's an obvious tension there, whether you try to decarcerate more or you build nicer facilities. And I'm not sure what the right balance is there. But something to be wary of, given the track record of private prison industry, the kind of proposals that we saw starting to surface this session to make prison conditions better, bringing in private industry. So yeah, that's kind of just a breakdown of that bill and that debate.
Michael, I think that that's a very good way of putting it. This, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, because conditions are deplorable. And 1921 would have created new prisons. So when we heard about it, it was like a train of advocates coming to oppose this bill because it's building more prisons. And this is something that I was very torn with because, you know, as an agency, we are against mass incarceration. But as a human being, I know that not everybody will get out of prison within the next 10 years. So would I like those people to be taken care of? Yes, 1,000%. And from what I know from personal experience, private prisons actually aren't that bad for the people inside. Now, that is a very controversial statement, and I'm sure not everybody will agree with that, but I'm just saying as personal experience, somebody who really cares about people suffering in there, I mean, something has to be done, something. And we can't just keep saying, well, we don't want new prisons, because Texas is not going to just let everybody out. As much as I would love for us to have all of these other options.
You're tuned in to an impressive recap of 2021 highlights today from our Civil Rights and Wrongs program here at Co-op Radio every Tuesday at 6 for the last 4 years. I'm Ken McKenzie Grant. And if you've ever learned something here, be it great news or unpleasant facts that you might wish weren't really true, now is the time to express your tax-deductible appreciation for this Austin nonprofit. We won't have a chance to ask you again until next spring, so please call the pledge line right now at 512-472-5667 or donate what you will via the web at koop.org. We have some new really useful gifts to include with your sustainer membership. Starts at $15 a month in this educational organization, and we would love to hear from you right now. Please call at 512-472-5667. Operators are standing by.
And we also have this to pledge drive, a special Civil Rights and Wrongs t-shirt. If you want to check it out, it's on our website, picture of it, so you can take a look at it. But the first three callers that call in at the $15 per month sustainer level or $100 per month or $100 one-time gift or above will have their choice of a medium, large, or extra large t-shirt if you happen to be one of the first callers. Because we only have three. So call in if you want to choose your size. But
you could conceivably get two t-shirts, a co-op t-shirt and a Civil Rights and Wrongs t-shirt.
Yes, exactly. So please do call us or go online to co-op.org and give us a pledge. We would love to hear from you. We love hearing from our listeners, and that's how we should know you support us.
Well, next up, we'll have excerpts from a show we did on July 6th. We spoke with Beth Schwartzapfel from the Marshall Project about the topic of qualified immunity. In a nutshell, qualified immunity makes it very difficult to sue police officers for misconduct, which is one reason why the ruling in the case of George Floyd was so remarkable.
Our guest this evening is Beth Schwartzapfel, award-winning staff writer for the Marshall Project, which seeks to create and sustain a sense of national urgency regarding the U.S. criminal justice system. Their goal is to render that system more fair, effective, transparent, and humane.
The court uses this standard that is really dissociated from the real world when they're deciding whether an officer should be liable for their mistake. They ask whether it was clearly established, whether the fact that the officer should not have done that was clearly established at the time that they did it. And their rule for whether something was clearly established or not is whether there is a court case in that particular district that has been published with very similar facts. So one case that came up recently that illustrates just how absurd this is. There was a case in the Pacific Northwest, I think it was Seattle, but don't quote me on that, where there was a bystander who had a cell phone and was filming the police beating a suspect. And the police took the guy's phone and deleted. Jim, do you know the details? Did they delete the video or did they tell him he wasn't allowed to film?
Yeah, I think actually both.
Anyway, the police had been trained that bystanders have a First Amendment right to film them doing their jobs. So the police knew very well that taking this man's phone away, deleting the video was not allowed, that he was protected. However, because there was no court that had published an opinion saying that that was protected by the First Amendment, that bystanders can film them, they were not allowed to be sued for that. So that's just one example of how the courts use this very esoteric rule to show whether a cop should have known they're not allowed to do something. And that rule is pretty far detached from reality.
You know, just to follow up on what Beth said too, I mean, this has come out in some awful, awful cases in prisons, for example, kinds of treatment that has been meted out to prisoners. And if you can't find a prior case, then there's immunity. And the thing is, this creates a circle in which there is no relief, because there will never be a published opinion with this sort of circular reasoning, right? So the court says, well, there's no published opinion, and therefore we can't give advisory opinions. Therefore, the cop is protected, or the prison officials are protected, and you ultimately never get relief. In the beginning, this rule came up about how to apply the reasonable cop, reasonable prison official standard, which is a standard that we use in general litigation, you know, in the private sector. But it's accumulated so much of this nonsensical immunity trappings that at the end of the day, no matter how outrageous the conduct might be, if there is no published opinion, then there's no relief. It's absolutely crazy where the courts have gone on this.
You know, I was doing a little bit of research for this program, and I am far from a legal expert. There was one case, that Jessup versus City of Fresno case. Apparently, the cops were executing a search warrant. They were inside a home and spotted some rare coins, which they stole. And they never denied stealing them. But because there was no prior case like this, the judge dismissed it. And it just seemed to me an example of just what you were talking about, Jim, just how absurd this can be taken.
Actually, it was a business. But the crazy thing was, they were executing a warrant for some minor thing, like the business had like a vending machine they weren't allowed to have or something. And the business owners were never actually charged with anything. So here the cops were executing a search warrant on a non-crime that nobody was ever charged with. And then they themselves committed a crime, or are alleged to have committed a crime. And yeah, the business owners weren't allowed to recoup any of the money they stole. It was rare coins, and it was cash, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash.
Wow.
You know, and the Supreme Court just had an opportunity to modify the rule last month, and it refused to do so, left intact the way the rule is. And I think everybody is to the point now where they acknowledge that the courts have gone way too far in trying to establish the balance that they say they want to establish. In reality, it's not a balance at this point. It's a tilt, dramatic tilt in favor of the cops or the officials.
The really fascinating thing here is that there are advocates for law enforcement who say that this is absolutely necessary, that cops are putting their lives in danger every day. And the last thing you want when they're in a dangerous situation is to have to stop and think about whether they're going to be sued, right? That they need to be able to act in a split second way to make decisions because it's the right thing to do and not because they're afraid of their finances. And I think that that is fair. We do want cops to be able to think on their feet. At the same time, I think what that does is set up a sort of false dichotomy that there's either qualified immunity or there's not. And what I think Colorado is proving is that there's another way. And that is, in Colorado, they recently passed some legislation that holds cops liable for a certain amount of money if they are found to have violated somebody's constitutional rights. I think it's $25,000. And in Colorado, I spoke to a gentleman who runs an insurance company who's now coming up with a personal liability insurance plan for police officers. And so just like a doctor has malpractice insurance, just like, as this insurance gentleman told me, his wife is a marriage therapist. She sits on a couch all day listening to people complain, and she has $1 million in personal liability insurance. Officers can pay into an insurance plan that won't break the bank, will protect them if they're sued, but still will take the onus off of taxpayers and will provide some recourse for people if they're wronged by the police. They can sue, and then the officer's insurance will pay out. And the really interesting thing about this, because the insurance company is now on the hook, they're going to want to try to come up with some kind of metrics, because this is what underwriters do, for which cops are a bigger risk and which ones are better cops that are not likely to get sued. And so people who have misconduct claims, people who have been sued in the past, they're going to pay a higher premium. And eventually the ones who are really bad cops that are a high risk, they're not going to be able to afford the liability insurance. And so in a way, market forces will actually do the work that our society seems to be unable to do, which is to weed out the bad cops.
I'd like to cite just a couple of other cases. Could either of you comment on Corbett versus Vickers, the case of the Georgia cop that shot a dog but wound up hitting a 10-year-old boy?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. The cop was chasing a suspect through a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood, and happened to run through this family's yard. This family had nothing to do with whatever case the cop was engaged in at that moment. They just happened to be in their yard at that time. And the cop ordered the family to lay down on the ground, which they did, including a 10-year-old who was lying face down on the ground. And apparently the family dog came trotting over as this cop was chasing a suspect. And the cop aimed at the dog and tried to shoot it. And he missed, and he shot the 10-year-old who was lying face down on the ground. And when the family sued, again, the cop was granted qualified immunity, that he was acting within the scope of his official duties, and he couldn't have known that that would violate the family's constitutional rights. They dismissed it because they said he was covered by qualified immunity, so the case was not allowed to proceed.
By the way, we learned about Beth from a May 3rd article in the Austin American-Statesman that she co-authored regarding the case of Trent Taylor. As prison maltreatment cases go, they don't get much more outrageous than that one. You can find more information by Googling Trent Michael Taylor. If you leave out the Michael, you'll be reading about a football player. Ken, how are things?
They're doing well. We're doing really well. We are, Michelle, Bob, and I, I'm really happy to be your guest this evening in here from the Co-op Radio Board of Directors. We're really happy to announce that our first anonymous pledge came in at over $300. And then Sandra Wright has also called 512-472-5667. And just a couple of moments ago, another anonymous connection for civil rights and wrongs came in at the $325 level. So we're so grateful, y'all, for your phone calls and your pledges online at KOOP.org.
Definitely. Definitely want to hear from you. So please give us a call, go online, and give us a donation so we know that you're there, you're listening, you appreciate what we do for you each and every week here on Civil Rights and Wrongs. It's been a pleasure to serve you. We would love your support.
Well, just moving right along here.
You are. You're speeding along, Bob. You're doing just great. Really, really great to be here.
Man, this is disorienting being back in the studio again, you know?
It is. But it's fun.
We'll make it work here, okay? We've been doing Civil Rights and Wrongs for 4 years now, and every year in July, we've done a show to wrap up the Supreme Court session. Our guest each year has been Stephen Vladeck, who holds an endowed chair at the UT Law School. Steve is CNN's lead analyst for the Supreme Court, and has himself argued cases before the court. Here are some of his observations from our July 13th show. Note that this was before the court's decision not to block the Texas SB 8, the new Texas law dealing with abortion.
We've had some changes in the makeup. How has that manifest itself in the decision, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bob, there's a lot of effort on the part of both some journalists and some interested parties to portray the most recent Supreme Court term as a pretty moderate one, and one in which the big headline, Justice Barrett replacing Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the claim is that it didn't really have that much of an impact. And I think that's just completely wrong and requires really squinting with one eye closed at the work of the court. I think we've seen, since Justice Barrett's confirmation last October, the court move very sharply to the right. In a couple of different ways, Bob, we've seen some high-profile merits cases where the court ruled 5-4 in a circumstance where had Ruth Bader Ginsburg still been on the court, it would have come out the other way. One big example of this was a ruling in a case called Arthrex about patent judges and why the means by which they're appointed and supervised is unconstitutional, ruling that has huge ramifications for the administrative state. But also on the so-called shadow docket, the orders that the Supreme Court issues in cases that aren't argued, there were at least three really high-profile rulings on the shadow docket this term, where the court was 5-4 with Justice Barrett in the majority and with Chief Justice Roberts joining the three Democratic appointees in dissent. And, you know, Bob, one of those rulings, the Tandon decision from April, articulated a pretty important new understanding of the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. So, you know, I think it's tempting for folks to look at the court and say, it's, you know, at most Justice Barrett's providing a sixth vote where there were already five. And I think that's just not accurate. And I think it downplays the extent to which it's a lot easier for the conservatives to take bigger steps to the right when there are six of them than when there are five of them. I think we're going to look back on this term as the most conservative term the Supreme Court has had since the 1930s, even if it might soon be eclipsed by what happens next term.
Yeah, unfortunately. And who knows what the makeup's going to be. I mean, a lot of talk about Breyer at this point. Do you have any speculation about that?
I mean, I understand why a lot of people are focused on Justice Breyer and whether he should retire. And given what happened with Justice Ginsburg, that makes sense. But, you know, the reality is I think it's very likely that by this time next year, Justice Breyer will have announced his retirement. And so President Biden will get to replace him, presumably with a Democratic Senate. And the key to me, Bob, is that even if President Biden is able to appoint a 47 or 48-year-old liberal to fill Justice Breyer's seat, that's not going to change that much on the court. I mean, I think we are looking at a pretty entrenched conservative majority, certainly for the near future, and barring some really unforeseen and unpredictable shifts in the court's composition. And so I think the focus on Justice Breyer is understandable, but I think misplaced, and ignores the extent to which the second coming of Bill Brennan in that chair, right, is not going to move the court that much compared to broader reforms, whether to the court or to the legal system, that, among other things, President Biden's Commission on Reform is currently looking into.
Well, thinking about the upcoming session, I lost count of all the cases that are already under consideration. But as you pointed out, there's a few big ones out there, the first of which dealing with abortion, Dobbs in Mississippi. Do you think that signals the end of Roe versus Wade, perhaps?
I don't think it sort of heralds the end of Roe versus Wade. I do think it's another step. You know, in Dobbs, what's happened is Mississippi has taken it upon itself to ban all abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. And under the Supreme Court's current caseload, under its current doctrine, women are still supposed to have a constitutional right to an abortion up until viability, which is not 15 weeks. And so in effect, Mississippi is banning an entire class of pre-viability abortions. If the court cares about upholding Roe and Casey, the two major precedents in the space, the Mississippi law should fall. If the court is interested in sort of another chip away at Roe by saying, well, viability isn't necessarily the constitutional line, Mississippi's allowed to move that line up to 15 weeks, well, then we get to Texas trying to move that line to 6 weeks, and then we get to Roe. So, you know, I think Dobbs itself does not require the court to overrule Roe, but a ruling in favor of Mississippi is, I think, a harbinger that even what's left of Roe is not long for this world. And everyone's going to be watching for, is the court willing to take that step? I think folks who say the court's going to overrule Roe in this case are overstating things, but only a bit.
And how about this Second Amendment case, Corlett? It involves the state of New York.
The court hasn't had a major Second Amendment case since 2010, and they had taken one from New York 2 years ago that New York had then mooted out by changing the underlying regulations. So this one looks to be the big kahuna. And the question in this case is, New York makes it all but impossible, even for lawful owners of firearms, to carry those firearms in public. There's a licensing regime, but it's very difficult to get a license. And the question the court agreed to take up is whether the restrictions on public carry violate the Second Amendment. None of the court's cases since it reinvigorated the Second Amendment in 2008 have addressed the question of outside the home. And so a decision that says, you know, the Second Amendment protects the right to public carry has enormous consequences. I think, especially in those states, unlike Texas, that have far greater restrictions on public carry. In states like Texas that have led the way, for better or for worse, in relaxing gun restrictions, I think that decision is probably less important.
Last year, we talked about that case, I think it was in Montana, dealing with funding for private schools. Looks like there's another case coming up next year, Carson versus Macon. Is that just one more step from that Montana case, or where's that going?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so this is the other end of the modern religious cases, right? That, you know, we've talked a lot about the free exercise clause so far on the show, but this is the establishment clause and what states are and are not allowed to do when it comes to providing access or denying access to funding programs to religious schools. And, you know, I think the court made clear in the Montana case, Espinoza, last year, that it's going to be very, very skeptical of state efforts to restrict religious schools' access to public funding. And so the grant, I think, in this case suggests it's going to sort of go one step further on that route as well. So at least for now, the biggest religion-oriented ruling of next term may be about the Establishment Clause, more so than the Free Exercise Clause.
Do you have any summary thoughts about this that we haven't discussed yet here?
I think the reality is that the Supreme Court is a very complicated institution. And one of the reasons why I love getting a chance to talk to you guys is because I think it takes some time to really hash out not just the top lines of these rulings, but their broader implications, both in context and for the court as a whole. And so, you know, to me, the real sort of story of the term, I think, is this is a very conservative court that is very comfortable in its own skin, and that at least for the moment seems to be feeling no pressure from Congress, from the White House, from anybody else to moderate its views, to moderate the speed at which it readjusts settled doctrines, to avoid high-profile cases like disputes over abortion and guns. And if that's what we're in for, then this is going to be a pretty remarkable, and I think from some perspectives, troubling couple of years for the Supreme Court, because there are plenty of lawyers out there who have pet theories they'd love to get before this court. And I think there are plenty of lower court judges who are willing to indulge them. And so I think we are looking at a court at once that is as conservative as almost any of us have seen in our lifetimes. And that is probably just at the beginning of what will end up being the most conservative run in the court's history.
You're listening to Co-op Radio. This is the News and Public Affairs Show, Civil Rights and Wrongs, every Tuesday at 6. Ken McKenzie in here with Michelle and Bob. And you know, folks, 472-5667 with a 512 in front of it, of course, is the number to call. I want to remind you that for a $175 single-time donation, or if you could sustain us with $25 a month, we have a great 16-gig flash drive gift we'd like to get you with the Co-op T-shirt. And Michelle?
And also the special Civil Rights and Wrongs t-shirt can be yours. One-time thing. You've got to be a caller, though. Call in 512-472-5667. And our wonderful volunteer will take your pledge. And we would love to hear from you. Any kind of comment you can make, tell us what you like about Civil Rights and Wrongs.
We're really excited, folks. We've had three anonymous pledges of support. One of them for the $325 one-time member, which brings you a 20-ounce Yeti tumbler in addition to the other gifts that we mentioned. Pledge online if that best suits your budget. You decide what it is. We'd love to hear from you and thank you on the air, and send us a comment too, please, would you?
Well, finally, let's hear from Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. As you're probably aware, we end most of our shows with an update from Austin on City Council, APD, or any number of issues that he's covering. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon.
It's Monday afternoon, September 20th, and we're talking with Austin Sanders once again, our buddy at the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing all right. How are you today, Bob?
Well, I'm okay. We're doing the fall membership drive again at Co-op, and real happy you could take just a couple minutes out to talk to the listeners. So I thought we'd just hear a little more about you. I think I've mentioned on some shows that you're actually an Austinite, right?
Yeah, born in the Runberg area in and around Austin ever since then. So, yeah, I am local.
And how long you've been with the Austin Chronicle now?
I guess it's been about 3, going on 4 years. I think it'll be 4 years in January. I started as an intern in the news section, then freelanced for a while, mostly covering Austin ISD, kind of the education beat, but mostly focusing on the district. And then started freelancing covering City Hall. And not long after that, they asked me to come on as a staff writer, where I still mostly just cover City Hall, public safety, stuff like that.
I'm really curious about how it is that you do your job. I mean, I know you cover city council, and I can pretty much piece that together. You go to all the city council meetings, obviously, and you take a lot of good notes. But what's it like covering APD? I mean, how do you know when something's happening there?
Yeah, APD is interesting, especially working at the Chronicle, where obviously we're proudly progressive. We cover these issues differently in terms of police accountability, the Black Lives Matter protests, stuff like that. We cover those issues differently than the Statesman or KUT, you know, important institutions, just a different part of the media ecosystem. And so sometimes our coverage is of police in particular can be a little bit harder to get sources to talk to me. A lot of times when I get information about APD, it comes from outside of the organization, right? It comes from someone at City Hall, someone in a related field, someone who works closely with APD, who says, you know, hey, have you heard about this thing? Have you heard about this incident or whatever it may be? You should look into it. And it's usually kind of having to work from the outside in, right? So I try to find out as much as I can about a police shooting or the hiring of the new police chief, which we're expecting an announcement on that soon. Those kinds of stories, I talk to people outside of the organization to get as much information as I can. And then I go to my sources within the department to say, hey, this is what I've heard. Does it sound correct to you? Are you hearing anything differently? And then kind of like as a last step is to go through the official public information office of the department. So yeah, with the police, it's a lot of kind of working from the outside to try to get to the inside of a story to really understand what's happening.
You've covered a variety of stories. Obviously, City Council and APD are the constants in there, but you did a number of stories on homelessness. And I remember early on in the pandemic, you covered AA meetings that went virtual. That was actually the cover story. You've done some other stories. What stories do you particularly enjoy covering?
I guess I have kind of a range. I do like the wonky policy type stuff, especially as it comes to housing. I think that's kind of like a really complicated issue at the local level, talking about what levers of power the city has in terms of allowing or restricting the housing supply. Being able to unpack those types of issues for readers, that would be really complicated and frankly understandable to just kind of gloss over for most people. It can be hard to really wrap your head around some of these issues. So those are interesting to kind of report. Homelessness, of course, is really a human story, right? Those are the parts that are the most appealing and I think that are the most important, getting to know the people living on the street or living in shelter or trying to exit homelessness, to learn more about the circumstances that may have led a person needing to sleep in a tent under a highway, right? For most of us, we can't really fathom what could have happened in a person's life to do that. And I think there's kind of a misconception among some segments of the public that people choose this lifestyle, that they want to live on the street by choice. And that may be true in some respects, but it really misses a big part of the story, which is that when people are making that choice, it's because typically they have been failed by institutions who say that they can help, whether it's government, charity, nonprofit, faith organizations that say we can help you find stable housing, find work. And people get left behind by these systems all the time. That breeds mistrust. That makes it harder for people to engage with these systems that are meant to help people in poverty. So that's an aspect of homelessness in particular that I really like, and getting to know the street level workers and organizations that are really doing the kind of messy, complicated humanitarian work for a population that's really in dire need.
You know, that really aligns nicely with Co-op's mission. basically, co-op is all about serving the underserved. If ever there were an underserved population in this town, it's got to be the homeless, you know.
The first time I recorded at co-op was for the Austin Monitor Radio Hour. I guess this was probably like 2.5-3 years ago, to talk about school board races. Yeah, it must have been the 2018 school board election. There was a bit of turnover, some surprising results at the AISD school board. So I came on to talk about that, and then maybe another segment on that show before the Austin Chronicle show got underway. And I was a pretty frequent guest recording in the studio, which was cool to, you know, work with engineers like yourself who really know this craft that's really a mystery to me, audio engineering, to kind of see it up close. How it works was fun, and it's been great to record with you mostly every week since the pandemic began, to give your listeners some insight in what's happening with our city government, and to really try and reach a different audience, people who may not read the Chronicle regularly. So to be able to talk to those people about the stories that we're covering is really satisfying for me.
Well, and we get to pick up a little nuance on things, too, that your voice would add. So it's been a real pleasure developing this relationship. You and I had only met once or twice, I think, before we started doing this. I got to say, it's a great compliment with an E, but also with an I. It's a great compliment to the other stories that we cover, the lengthy interviews that we do, to pick up what's going on, you know, in City Hall and at APD. And we're so grateful for that. And it's been our pleasure to have you. Well, again, thanks so much for your contributions to co-op and our show in particular. And we look forward to the next time, okay?
Yeah, I'm always glad to participate, you know, co-op Austin Institution. So glad to contribute even in my own small capacity. But thanks for the opportunity for allowing me to do that.
Thank you, Bob, for producing the Austin Chronicle program, in addition to Civil Rights and Wrongs. And thanks for having me in this evening, Michelle and Bob. It's been great. We've had three anonymous sustainer pledges come in at the $50 a month level. We're very, very grateful for that. And also to Sandra Wright and to Bob Cuddy.
Tom Cuddy.
I'm looking at Bob. Tom Cuddy. Thanks, you guys. This is Co-op Radio. Civil Rights and Wrongs will be back next week. But once again, if you want to make that last-minute pledge at whatever level you can afford, 512-472-5667 or pledge online at kop.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you for listening to KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 FM, community radio for Austin since 1994. Co-op continues our 24-hour stream of music and local programming at koop.org, where there is also more information on our diverse programming schedule. Find us back on 91.7 FM tomorrow morning, beginning at 9 a.m. Until then, KVRX Student Radio for UT Austin will broadcast on this frequency. Thank you for being part of your community radio station. Radio for people, not for profit.